Today's episode of the APA podcast is sponsored by Tyler Technologies. Tyler's EnerGov technology offers comprehensive, automated, and connected civic services software for smart government operations. From planning, permitting, and licensing to asset management and citizen requests, visit tylertech.com/EnerGov to learn more. That's tylertech.com/ENERGOV.
Welcome to the American Planning Association podcast. This episode continues our series that takes a look at the people behind the plans, showcasing the work, life, and stories of planners from all across the profession. I'm your host, Courtney Kashima, founder and principal at Muse Community Design, a planning and public engagement studio in Chicago, Illinois. I'm also a longtime member of the American Planning Association. My guest today is Rasmus Astrup, a partner and design principal with SLA. SLA is a nature-based design studio based in Denmark and Norway. Rasmus was featured in a panel at the National Planning Conference earlier in 2021 entitled Strategies to Combat Extreme Heat. The session received a lot of buzz, and we wanted to hear more from him on this topic. Rasmus, thanks for being here.
Thanks for inviting me. It's a great pleasure, and it is indeed true that there was a lot of, I think I was talking 6 minutes on the conference, and of course we had the Q&A afterwards, but it was amazing the feedback that we got from that conference, so I'm happy to follow up. It was really amazing to hear how this is just becoming a global issue.
Before we dig into that, I'd like to just hear a little bit more about yourself as a person.
Well, my name is, as you said, Rasmus. I am 44 years old, currently sitting in my bedroom, actually, in my house here in Copenhagen, where I live with my wife and two kids. I am also a person that just... Normally is coming home from one country and on my way to another. So as in that sense, I just came back from Abu Dhabi. So I am a guy that travels a lot because I am leading the international projects. I don't own a car. I bicycle to work every day. Our studio is like 10 minutes away on my bike. I love to swim in the harbor that is also 10 minutes away as long as I can. Winter is too much, but and then I do I try also to run to reduce stress and keep focus in my life. So that's, I think, me.
Excellent. I read that you grew up in a collective. I'm curious how that shaped your thinking about nature and places and how it might inform your work.
I think it informed my social values primarily. That you live in a place where you don't have your own room, so all the kids were sleeping in sharing one bedroom, and you shared your toys and stuff. So I think that it gave me a first of all social perspective, but of course during those times where we were living in those places, that was also where I was driven by, you know, organic food, you know, sustainable approaches. So I think I got that from, I was very small, that there is a different way to do things than the conventional way. So it gave me an insight on early inspiration that you don't necessarily need to buy the cheapest food. You don't necessarily need to have the most expensive clothes. And so it's not that I am living the hippie life that I was brought up to. My wife was living even more hippie than I was, but it brought some values that I think is good. But I think the nature also came from my grandparents who were farmers, conventional farmers. So there was always a conflict in our family between my mom who broke up with that and wanted to have organic ecological farming, completely against my conventional grandparents and how they grew. And then at the same time, they actually had a little piece of nature land that they preserved, and that was full of birds and just wild growing nature where I was playing my entire childhood. So I saw both worlds, and I think that was a big inspiration for me. And I'm not against farmers, by the way. I do understand why they are here, but I don't want to make this into a podcast about that. But yeah, it influenced my life in a way, so I have continued taking some of those choices. I'm still eating organic. I don't eat meat. I try to buy sustainable clothes and so on. So I think that's what it brought me.
I think, like many of today's issues, things are far more nuanced than, you know, people want to admit. So I don't think anyone's going to come away with the impression that you're anti-farmer. I want to talk a little more about the work of your firm. You're leading projects or have led projects across the globe. Many of them are large and complex. And I know SLA is known for helping to solve complex urban problems, but really with this nature-based design approach. Can you share some examples of your work and a little bit about the approach you take?
I can. I think just the fact that we call ourselves a nature-based design studio, and both of those items or subjects in the title are important. So the nature based means that we are finding our inspiration in the values of nature, in the processes of nature, and in the aesthetic as inspiration you can find. The way nature touches you. So that's why we are an interdisciplinary design firm. And our approach is based on that hardcore knowledge, you can say. So we often bring a biologist and an anthropologist and a designer and myself to a meeting, for instance. It's not just a group of architects, even though we are a land classical, you would define us as a landscape architectural firm. We call us a nature-based design studio. And then design is important. We have a special DNA that is an inspiration about nature and the fact that nature is a process, but it's not just without control, right? We are designing things in cities and on top of buildings and so on. So of course, there's a design element in it. So we care a lot about aesthetic values, about materiality, light, and so on. So we are just trying to optimize all of those parameters. And it means that, for instance, one of our breakthrough projects, unfortunately on hold politically, was, for instance, one in Paris, where there was this mega competition about a site on top of Le Périphérique, which is a highway that separates the arrondissements, meaning the actual city center of Paris, with the suburbs. And it's a barrier that pollutes insanely. It makes noise, and you cannot cross it physically because it's a low point. So we discovered that was the most polluted site actually in Paris. And then Paris is one of the most, if not the most polluted site in a city, in Europe. So our approach, besides doing a nice concept and a beautiful design of the courtyard and all that, was it also had to clean the air. So it's just a great example of how we then studied. I was meeting a professor in Hong Kong, and I met a professor in Sydney who were the most leading expert in how to clean air pollution with plants. One of them is using mushrooms. That's the one in Hong Kong. They literally eat. It's because the pollution goes into the soil, and then the roots, the mycorrhizae mushroom roots, they break down the pollution. The other guy uses technical ventilation, like the little one you have behind of your computer, that cools down your motherboard or whatever it is it cools down. That part is dragging in the polluted air, and then the plants are breaking it down, making it into nutrients, and then releasing nothing else than fresh air. So it's two approaches, but again, that is not enough. It's then assembled into a design. So besides being what we consider beautiful, we look at the spatial experience. It's how can we integrate it with the building, understanding the light, the material, and all that. We are working on this at the same time on a very nerdy, super, I mean, we bought like 10 books of mushrooms, about mushrooms and stuff. I mean, it's like at a parallel line, there was something about clean air. And I think that is very much in a nutshell how we work. It's constantly about attracting bird species that used to live on that side. It's like solving an issue, but it's not just a global agenda. It's also a way to find an inspiration, because suddenly that thing influenced. We had to tell the architects how to design the buildings. It's also us, SLA, we can be a little annoying, maybe, if you are a classical architect who put some masses out there, and then I have my moment to shine, where I can select some tree species to put on the corners or the leftover spaces. It doesn't work like that. It's one project. I'm not designing buildings. We have architects, but we don't think we are the best to design buildings. But we think we are very good at placing buildings, masses, in the urban realm. And to basically see things from a different perspective. I don't know if that answered your question.
So basically you go around telling architects their buildings need more mushrooms. That's what I took away.
Yeah, I tell them about I talk about mushrooms. And basically, like you said, that is sometimes our challenge, that because we are so nerdy, We need to constantly remind clients and architects, and maybe also sometimes ourselves, that we are designers. We are a design firm. We have won so many awards. We are really doing. We have been awarded for light design, for the best landscape design, and so on. We have all this expertise. But it has another value embedded in the design, and that is hard, because when you suddenly start to let biodiversity influence your design, people think, okay, it's because you're just like are you more like a biologist than a no, I'm just working with if an architect didn't care about daylight, I will also think he's stupid. So I think an urban planner who doesn't care about biodiversity is the same level, because cities is where the majority of the population is living. And for me, even though it's tough to say it, I know we are in a crisis right now, I think the biodiversity crisis is the most scary one. And it's irreversible. You cannot get anything back every time you lose something from the biodiversity. So it's very tough. And I would go as far as say the reason why we have this pandemic is because of loss of biodiversity. It's because those viruses have nowhere else to go than human beings, because we are occupying too much space. So we need to find another way to design our cities. We need to make space for not just human beings, but also animals and other insects, like bees and butterflies and plants, and accept that you can't tame or control everything. It's so old school to think you can control everything. We recently did a very cool camp in our firm, where we went off grid. So we took all the three studios and brought them next to a lake in the countryside. Biocompostable toilets that were actually quite they were not so nice, even though they were sustainable. Sleeping in tents, swimming in the lake, food made over fire, no electricity. It was really amazing. Bonfire, lots of alcohol, obviously, to socialize. And then the day after, we had a philosopher and a writer who came, and then we discussed things about our approach. And he just brought this up. He's called Thor Nørretranders in Danish. He's very famous, and he wrote a book called Corona Karma, and it's just amazing how he describes that we have philosophically or fundamentally treated the world wrongly. We have focused on the wrong items. It's always been about this cup. How does it look? The one I have my tea in. It's the tap that releases the water, and there's a little item you can put in, and then it's 20% less. There's this iPhone that uses 20% less, but in reality, it's not about that tap. It's the water that comes out of it, and he calls that flow. It's not about what type of solar or windmill, or it's about the flow of energy. There is a flow of energy. There is a flow of food also, but we are not seeing ourselves as part of it. We are seeing ourselves as people that's harvesting. We use all the oil until there's no more left. We just make these mega farms until the nature breaks down. But so it's that's not the right way to see it. And it was really thoughtful, and I understood that basically we need to change things. And that's why I think this awareness about these items is so important in cities. Maybe we cannot solve everything in the cities, but the awareness, because that's where people are, they are in the cities, is why it's so important. And I mean, his idea was to just, separate the earth into two aspects, one for nature and one for human beings, 50-50. That's the only way. Very interesting idea, but it's this idea about, and it's becoming a very philosophical like visionary talk here, but it's this idea about, I think what the pandemic also taught me is that there's just one globe, right? And I think that's why, for me, why biodiversity is such an important driver. And it's biodiversity is, by the way, also the solution for urban heat, is that, you know, the birds don't know if they belong to Chicago or Atlanta. You know, they actually have no clue. And the cow doesn't know where that the animals don't care about these things. And you know, if you go even longer back in time, I mean, who knew? Then the territories were different. So these territories that came up under the pandemic, that suddenly everybody become very nationalistic. It was very weird for me that suddenly states in US started to blame other states. Suddenly Canada and US, Denmark and Sweden, everybody was like, you know, going against each other. But the problem was a global one. That's just, I mean, there's a global problem. And I think that's where we need to go. Biodiversity is a global thing. It's all, there's, the fish are just swimming in one sea, you know. They don't belong to any country. So I think it would be very nice to approach our future in that sense, that we are part of something bigger. There, I mean, the newest approach is this donut thinking that is very popular right now by a clever woman that I forgot her name now, but she's super cool. And what I like about that is that there's this discussion about the capacity of the earth instead of a country or, you know, a city. And that's appealing for me, that we as human beings start to talk to each other, learn from each other, get inspired from each other. That Abu Dhabi that I just came from can learn from Denmark. I can learn from Chicago. And I mean, that's, we should all solve this together. And that's definitely a driver.
You give a lot of food for thought. And yes, the imaginary lines that humans have drawn on maps and hold quite dearly to don't matter to nature, right? Waterways, for example.
Waterways is the best example, because there's this, when we work with waterways, when we work with stormwater management, we are working in Vancouver. We are working in Detroit, for instance. Those two are good examples. And the plan is, Vancouver is pretty advanced. They are now starting to really, and London is doing the same, merge the silos, because that's another problem, that there is silo thinking in all the cities. So the guys who work with biodiversity don't collaborate, the one with stormwater and the utilities, it's all different. But if you really need to change it, they need to collaborate, right? So this thing is starting to work. But then when you really want to solve the stormwater, the problem is, like you say, you're not allowed to cross another man's boundary. But the water don't care. I mean, the water goes to the lowest point. So these imaginary lines, these borders and control and systems we have, it's a great example. Water don't follow anything either. I mean, water don't follow nada. I mean, it goes from one state to another without thinking about it. It just follow the topography. It's so simple. And that's a conflict for us to solve a water issue when it goes from one ownership to another. I mean, how dumb are we in it? I mean, we need to collaborate more. I know it's money, it's funding, it's political, but it's just fundamentally stupid.
So until we make progress on overcoming jurisdictional, you know, limits and challenges of working together, what do you want planners in particular to know about biodiversity and perhaps what they can do about it, about preserving it, enhancing opportunities, and so on?
I think it's weird when you do design a new project in Denmark. Let's take Denmark because I'm sitting in Denmark. There is a manual of 600 pages about the energy consumptions, about the isolation requirements, about the how to fix the roof to, I mean, the carrying weight of all the beams. I mean, there's engineers who spent lives of hours in designing and judging and defining how these regulations should influence any decision you make. But there's no regulations about biodiversity. There's no books. There's no description. So you can basically just take down a forest and then do a tree. But then there's some green ratio, there are some net gain biodiversity demand starting to happen, but it's weird that it's not described anywhere as important as the isolation requirements in your building, or how much daylight you need in your office space, or all these others. So I mean that the weight can carry, I mean the floor should carry your weight so you don't fall down to the people living underneath you. Yeah, but you should also take care of biodiversity. And I think fundamentally we should start to have that debate. We are right now working with a new developer here in Denmark, where we are starting to implement a net gain biodiversity. Net gain biodiversity means that you don't, it's not enough just to maintain the biodiversity that was already there, but you need to create more, right? And that strategy is complicated, but it's a requirement. Like there's a requirement for traffic lights and grills for stormwater. We should start to think about biodiversity the same way, and that's so important. It's life quality in the end. It's also design. It's like bringing, and it has two aspects. Again, I'm starting to talk about like I am a biologist, but I'm not. I'm a landscape architect by degree, and I'm a designer, and I care about life quality. And I think that that urban life quality is very much defined about the presence of biodiversity, or you could say what we call city nature. I think it's important to prioritize such things in cities because they're the social glue in a city. So one thing is this biodiversity aspect I mentioned. Another thing is all the ecosystem services they can bring. You know, they can lower the temperature, they can take up all the storm water, prevent urban heat, which is was the subject we talked about on the conference, right? But fundamentally, it's also about life quality. It's a sense of belonging. This is, I mean, you behave differently. If you got that feeling of walking in a forest with your friends every time you left your room, I'm telling you, you will not be so stressed. You will be more happy. You know, your kids will be more clever, and you will also be breathing cleaner air. So fundamentally, we have to create or introduce a new hierarchy in cities. And it's starting to happen. I mean, the 15-minute neighborhoods are, of course, important. Soft mobility, all these things are there happening, but it's not there yet. And as I said, for this developer that we work with in Denmark, it's still in the very early stage compared to how defined all these building regulations are. For instance, how long is the demand to achieve net gain biodiversity? Is it 1,000 years? Is it 100 years? 3 years? 10 years? Who knows? I mean, of course, I can claim I will do net gain biodiversity if somebody find the piece of paper I made 1,000 years after. I mean, so what is the requirements? What I'm trying to say is still buzzwords. Everybody says biodiversity. Yeah, but what do you mean about what? What is the so? We need to take it more serious. That's my call out to the urban planners. And by doing that, we get all the other benefits as social glue. Urban heat island will be reduced a lot, stormwater management and so on. Because cities are fundamentally really dumb. It's warmer in Abu Dhabi than it is in the city. I mean, in the desert. I mean, the desert has a better microclimate than in the middle of the city, because extortion from the cars, that is like 3-4 degrees itself, all the AC that just leaves. Cities are just heating up themselves. They are creating the worst environment for people, and they're constructed by people. That's not so smart.
We hope everyone is enjoying the show. Support for today's show includes Tyler Technologies, Tyler's Civic Services Solutions allows you to work with citizens efficiently and effectively, enabling your agency and community to thrive. From planning, permitting, and licensing to asset management and citizen requests, Tyler's industry-leading EnerGov software automates, connects, and streamlines your critical government processes. Whether it's enterprise workflow, management, inspection, enforcement, or electronic plan review, EnerGov can do it all. Visit tylertech.com/EnerGov today to learn more. That's tylertech.com/ENERGOV.
So as you mentioned, your firm has won many awards for your work. I want to hear more about specific projects, perhaps Toronto, Detroit, Copenhagen, but others as you might share. Because there's a tendency, just like some of these concepts are hard to grasp or philosophical, and I think it's important to bring it down to a practical level. Some projects perhaps seem sexy or have a cachet, but I'd like you to share what about them is replicable or planners and designers should learn from, particularly perhaps the aspects of like the design is one thing, and that might be what wins awards, but there's other important aspects such as communication, collaboration, maintenance, and those like less sexy aspects, but that are just as important.
Lovely, wonderful question. And they are less sexy, but they are the most important key to actually change things. There are so many biodiverse city, and then you write city, visions, concepts, renders out there. There is so much of that. I think a very good example is a project we did in Denmark that is the first climate adaptive neighborhood. And it's really transforming a former road area, sidewalks, into a forest where you can still park and drive, but there's a compromise that is new. There's a new agenda here, and it feels like a forest when you walk there. It's retaining a lot of stormwater. It's full of biodiversity and birds. It's a complete new atmosphere when you go there, and there is new shops and cafes that so for F&B it was an asset, but it was completely driven by the process and not the project. It was driven by super engaged citizens, a municipality who managed to really find an internal team that were big believers, and they managed to get alignment with the utilities for financial issues. So yeah, the less sexy, annoying thing was that project was basically financed by private landowners, utility services, and the municipality. That took maybe years before they could agree about that. One thing is to do all these nice renders. That was the fundamental thing for making such things happening. And politically, it was not even legal because utility services are not allowed to sponsor nice stuff. Utility services, they can only pay for tubes and gravel on top of it, right? So again, it's the political system, right? So yeah, that was one part of it. Then the other part was the engagement with the local citizens, finding them, because it's often like that we sit here, we are talking, finding out these amazing ideas, but we need someone else to be ambassadors after we leave the project. And that happened there because they took ownership. They have one group that is having a lot of bird facilities, you know, the small houses where they can make sure that they can be protected and lay on their eggs. There are somebody that cares about the plantings. There's all these groups, and it's an urban realm. That's my point here. It's an urban realm. So it's a street that feels like a forest, and I think that is one of the best projects. It's a project where we had to spend as much time on design as on maintenance, because they didn't know how to maintain it. They didn't know how to prevent soil from going. So we need to prevent a special stormwater grill. It's literally, if you imagine, a long grill. Overscale because of the stormwater capacity. But then in the winter time, we don't want the storm, the rain to go into the planting beds. So what happens is in the summertime, we close that grill system, you know, that inlet, and then the water goes in. In the winter, it's opposite. We need to have this inlet open, so the water goes down to the drain system. Not that it rains so much in the winter because of the salt. So how could we, and it's something we have been discussing for like years and years with the municipalities. And it went into a design where there is a big thing for a key. And then there's a sun and a snowflake. So when it's summer, the maintenance guy turns the grill over to the sun. And when it's winter, they turn it over to the snowflake. And I have presented that project for like people from Japan, US, all the countries in Europe. And they are all amazed about how smart it is. But it's those things. And it shows how complicated it is. But if you don't fight those battles, you don't change things. I have another good example that I just came back from Abu Dhabi today, and we did a biodiversity park in Abu Dhabi. And people don't understand that you can actually contribute to biodiversity in a city that primarily has sand, no soil. But you can. There are local species, and SLA spent a year investigating all the 700 species of local plants in the UAE, in the United Arab Emirates, to get the knowledge that we felt was enough to really be able to design in that country. And eventually that led to this opportunity to design a park, which we of course made into a biodiversity park. It has two purposes. It lowers the temperature with up to 10 degrees. Because of control of natural wind system, low points, materials that has a high light reflection, and then the shadow of all those trees, and that's such an amazing park. I literally feel so it touches me very deeply when I go there, because it's the essence of what we believe, that nature is part of every country's culture. You know, that it's really linked, and if you can get that, it's not about religion, it's not about which country you're from. This, it's just about right there at that spot, that's how nature looks like. And that park looks different if it's in Chicago where you're sitting, or if it's in Denmark where I'm sitting now. That park looks different. Because nature is different, and of course, because we would design it in another way. But my point was, so we managed to do that. We fought for all these local species. It's the first park in UAE that has no lawns, because lawns are not sustainable. So we said it's okay. This park is made for human beings, but also insects and butterflies and all that. So beehives start to appear together with bird nests. The bird nests they can live with, even before it's finished, the birds start to move into the park. and we are so happy about it. Then the beehives comes, and they are so afraid, because you know bees. Is it safe? It's, by the way, not dangerous. And it's so interesting that next to those beehives is a 6-lane road full of the biggest 4-wheel drive car you can imagine. And if your girl or little kid run there, they just die. There's air pollution from that road. But they are not afraid of that street. They're afraid of those bees that supports the whole ecosystem. And there's no rules anywhere. Actually, the rules are beehives are dangerous, remove them. So I go down there. I have made a lot of interviews in DC, like daily. It's all over the news. This park, it's really been a successful story. So the contractor of the firm sends a email to the municipality of Abu Dhabi, an official one, adding me CC, and then brings two articles and say, I think you misunderstand. I cannot remove the beehives. Because as quoted here, this park is designed for biodiversity, including bees, butterflies. And I'm like, I'm crying, right? When the contractor starts to fight for biodiversity, that's where the magic happens. But he loses the battle something happens. So I went out there. I was there 2 days ago, and I said, so we need to discuss it. There are some organizations here who knows how to handle beehives so it's safe and you don't have to worry about it. They say, yeah, but we made our own rule because every time we close down a beehive, another one starts. So the bees has won. So now the agreement is that all the beehives along the edge near the road are allowed to stay in the park. So I think this is an amazing example of we need to change behavior, right? We need to design parks that are also for bees because they are actually important for the plants. And now they are in the park. They are also inhabitants. And I think it's so beautiful.
I love those small victories. Thank you for sharing. So yeah, the contractor, changing the contractor's attitude is probably not going to win you an award, but you know that it's monumental.
No, but it's so true. That was actually an award. Right. I mean, to achieve a contractor writing, taking ownership, that is an award there, or I don't know, it's a success.
It is. But you're not winning international design competitions because of that.
No. But that's also not why I'm in this business. It's nice to win international design awards, but it's not my
motivation.
Yeah.
So you were just sharing that some things are sort of held constant or remain the same. In my words, I would say an explicit and intentional approach to designing with nature rather than against it, you know, with avoiding temptations to sort of tame nature or overcome it. And actually start with nature as a design principle in order to achieve all of the benefits that humans and plants and animals can benefit from. On the other hand, local knowledge or local conditions can vary quite widely. And I'd like to hear a little bit more about the importance and role of local knowledge in some of your projects because you do work all across the globe.
We do, and then again, we don't work all across the globe because it is actually difficult to ensure that quality that we want to achieve and bring that knowledge that we also demand from ourselves. So we have some markets that we focus on. And in those markets, we have a fulfilling knowledge, but it's always linked with local knowledge. So there is always a collaboration. That's like the biggest inspiration. I mean, we are designers. We go out and approach things based on our DNA. But it's a collaboration, And man, I mean, it's so healthy to go out there. First of all, a lot of the collaborations with the local companies, it's changing a little bit now, but I just came from, as I said, Abu Dhabi. I think I had 3 meetings where I had to explain who is SLA, who am I? And you should never be annoyed about doing that. It's so healthy to be forced to convince others about what are your values, why are you interesting to participate in this collaboration. So that's one thing that I get out of it, is that you stay humble and motivated to meet other people and learn, because man, I mean, the knowledge that is out, that it's so amazing, the knowledge and approach that you meet out there. You meet plant expertise, you meet First Nation experts in Canada, you meet biodynamic farmers in Abu Dhabi I never thought was possible. By the way, beehivers, I have a whole network of bee farmers in organic in Abu Dhabi. You go out and when we came to Downshoe the first time, I remember I met the client and we talked a little bit about urban farming, and you know, there's a very famous urban farm where we did our climate neighborhood in Copenhagen, and we have done some projects other places in Denmark and in France, so I felt like maybe I could bring some knowledge there. And then he showed his like 10 times bigger facility, mega professional, full of all the social values. And suddenly I was like, okay, I'm going to take some notes here, and then I will like to learn from you. And it's just one of many examples of how, when we go abroad, it's not just us bringing knowledge. Oh man, we are bringing back so much knowledge. So it's a thing that we enrich our firm and studio with new knowledge. That's what you get out of collaborating and working abroad.
So returning for a minute to the panel you were a part of at the National Planning Conference, Strategies to Combat Extreme Heat. I want to talk a little bit more about extreme heat. What are the impacts on cities? What's being done to mitigate it? What should our listeners learn about?
Yeah, I mean, we just saw all of us this new, was it UN, the new report that stated that basically all these climate deniers should just keep quiet now, that it is scientifically proved that the reason we have all these extreme heat events is because we are hurting the climate, we are hurting the globe that we are all sharing. And urban heat is one of the biggest climate killers globally. There are people that literally dies of urban heat. I think the best example was this year's accident in Vancouver. I don't know if you heard it. They broke the record of the hottest day. People died. I don't recall how many, but if it was 60 or 70, it also doesn't matter, but just the fact that people die of urban heat, the fact that the ecosystems in Vancouver is going to suffer for maybe the next 10 years, you know, the amount of salmon, it was like a lot of the bottoms of the lakes and the sea just, they turned around. They were literally boiling the ecosystem in all the water ecosystems, right? So that's horrible. Urban heat is really a big thing. It's happening. I just returned from 45 degrees. That was also some sort of urban heat, you can say. But I think we need to solve this. And again, it's fundamentally rethinking the way we design cities. Cars are heating up cities. And buildings are heating up cities. I mean, how stupid is that? That's the two elements. I mean, so the infrastructure, the the buildings. So we need to consider them differently. Maybe we should grow our cities instead of building them. I don't know what we should do, but there's an element here that is very important. And it's not just enough to plant some trees. What we can do as landscape architects or urban planners is that we can support the quality of the microclimate and make it a better condition. But it's not like we can solve the overall issue of urban heat. And it's changing the perspective. Crazy. I mean, in Downsview in Toronto, where we are working on this former military airport that is transforming into a very, very big city. And the timeline is 2050 before it's done, because it's so huge, the scale of the site. Transolar, very famous by a sustainable engineering firm, right? That knows about climate change. They calculated that would be like Barcelona. So actually, if we should take it serious, we should design the entire city of that. It is actually literally a city according to a different climate than today. Denmark will be warmer. So, I mean, there will also be more heavy rains.
So I want to stop for just a second, because you're talking about a project in Toronto that, based on the data, made a significant sort of philosophical shift upon learning that their climate was going to be more like that of Barcelona, which is quite Mediterranean, quite different than Toronto, instead of sort of dancing around the edges and continuing on a course. They made a big departure to say, we acknowledge the climatic impacts and are going to design in a way to address that. I just want that to sink in with people, because that's a big deal.
It's a very, very big deal. I can tell you that right now I'm making a quote for a big new project in Toronto, and you know what the subject is? It's urban heat policy. So the winter city, the snow city, feels it's about time to make an urban heat policy. Makes no sense, right? But they need to do that, because the summers are getting so extremely warm. They are still having snow in the winter, it's a global thing. It is happening, and the cities are suffering from it. Greece had the same problem. Athens, I mean, it's literally impossible to be there. I was there in August this year, and yes, there is this global thing that we need to solve. We are all part of the same planet and so on. We need to consider different ways to harvest energy and et cetera. But we literally can contribute as urban planners by thinking it differently. And I think one of them is to take it serious in the matters, as you just said, to say, okay, what is the time span here? Because I literally need to design my master plan according to a different condition than the current one. And that's really thought provoking.
Yeah, definitely. In the U.S., there was a lot in the news about Seattle, for example, that in the past, Seattle might have received a couple of days that were hot, but most houses don't have central air conditioning, and they're simply unprepared for the heat they received this summer, and it doesn't seem like it's going to change. So I wanted to talk to you about, we know that the impacts of these types of events are not equally distributed, right? There's disproportionate impacts on most vulnerable populations.
I think it's something where I feel that North America are in a much better direction than Scandinavia is. I think it's because we have a welfare society. So we don't have the same issues about lack of social equity, but it's really in Detroit and Toronto, for instance, as these two cities where we have projects, where I feel the strongest conversation about prioritize according to social income when you do climate adaptation. Prioritize urban heat effects, how they will influence according to social income. So you start to plan according to those values, because yes, it's really hitting completely unfair, and the same goes. I mean, all the nice neighborhoods, they have AC, they have a lot of trees. You know, it's so logic. There was a big report also made in Canada, and I think it was actually about Vancouver, where they measured the amount of trees according to income, and rich people just have nicer outdoor environment than poor people. It's that unfair, and that's why we should focus on the urban realm as a social glue. We should definitely make our prioritizations the sustainable prioritization, because it is a prioritization, because we are not solving everything at the same time, always including those social aspects and considering social equity. And it's tough, you know. We had a project in Denmark where it was a very low income, not so nice area. We made an urban string, a former train track. So there was now a very nice park that became mega popular. So even though all the housing estates adjacent to it have an internal courtyard, they started to use the public space instead, the park we designed. And suddenly everybody's like, yeah, it's so cool. It's a late design. And it was a very unique design where there was like, we didn't design all the details, you know. So we left things for people to inhabit it so they could do, we want table tennis. Well, there's a space for you. We didn't over design it. You know, we did a frame. So people took ownership. And then the property values just started to rise insanely. So every time I present that project, I used to have a slide about the property value that was gained from it compared to the cost of the project, and especially in US and Canada, when I do lectures in university, it's the first thing the student asks. But how do you feel about that? Not supporting social equity, and I think the answer is that's because the urban realm is so stupidly bad, because cities are, I mean, all outdoor spaces in a city should feel like that park.
Because and there should be a lot of them.
Yes.
Distributed everywhere.
Exactly. That is the reason why it has such a big influence, because the rest of the urban spaces are so bad, because cities are literally not in a good condition. They could at least be in a much better one.
Well, I appreciate learning a little more about you and your firm and your work. A way I like to wrap up the conversation is ask your opinion on what you think the field of planning is getting right these days, and then perhaps where there is still work to do.
There's always work to do. I mean, when there's no more work to do, we don't have any reason to do this podcast. And then I will just, move to the countryside and grow my own food or something. Yeah, then I will retire with that. But I think there's a movement that is interesting towards a respect of biodiversity, to take a thing such as Urban Heat Island, as the feedback I got from the conference was really touching, and it made me think a lot. I can see there are new policies popping up, like the one I mentioned in Toronto. There is net gain biodiversity demands in London. there is something happening in Toronto. It used to be the leading one. Before that, it was Paris. So I would say my advice or my suggestion is have a global focus. Understand what I mean. The knowledge. I mean that you don't have all the solutions. Basically, that's my best advice. Accept and understand you don't have all the solutions, and it's not in your country the best solutions are. It's a mix of all the things that is happening globally right now, and the more we can cross collaborate between countries, entities, design firms, the better. And I think that is really a key here, because there is so much wasted knowledge. I mean, there are so many taking baby steps at the same time instead of talking to someone who already solved everything, you know. So I think I don't know what the key is, but I think we should it's turning back to this shared ownership of the earth, but also the way we make cities. And I think we should, just the fact that I was invited to talk on this conference in US, I got so much knowledge that I brought back to Denmark. So I think my advice is to keep asking questions, keep being curious, and have a global interest, because there is answers and some of the best solutions in every country, and it's only by adding them together that you can really become clever and up to date.
Well, I'll take this opportunity to say, if our listeners would like to watch Rasmus's session from the National Planning Conference of 2021, you can access it on APA Learn at learn.planning.org. And then, Rasmus, I'd love to hear if there are any resources you'd like to share. It could be an interesting book, podcast, things you've been inspired by recently. And then if listeners want to find out more about you or your work, please share those handles, website, or information.
I would like to make a little advertisement about that we are making a new website. And it's probably launched when this podcast is out. And what we are trying to do with that website is to turn it into a universe, so you can actually not just see our projects, but you can coordinate, you can map them according to stormwater, you can read about a philosopher we are inspired by, you can read about materials, about soil types. So I think that if it works, I would recommend everyone to go there. There's also a lot of the books or magazines that we have written ourselves. You can download. One is called Why We Love Trees. It's a very, very good one that is arguing hardcore, evidently based. So you can use it when you have to discuss with politicians and colleagues why trees can, you know, reduce crime, reduce heat, reduce maintenance cost, and so on. So that's a whole book about that. And then for myself, what am I reading right now? Right now, I am reading a book about Abu Dhabi, because that's where I work right now. I'm reading two books about Abu Dhabi. One is about the urban realm, and another one is the first female PhD who wrote about the history of urban planning and how all Middle Eastern cities learned to design cities according to American engineers, and why it is, to be honest, a little bit of a disaster.
Interesting. I'll have to check those out. Well, I can't thank you enough for making time to talk with us today. I learned a lot. And as I said, a lot of things to think about, big questions, specific actions. I appreciate all of it. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to another episode of the American Planning Association podcast. To listen to past episodes, visit planning.org/podcast. If you're enjoying the show, please rate us on iTunes. And don't forget to subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Thanks for listening. Today's episode of the APA Podcast was sponsored by Tyler Technologies, empowering the public sector to create safer, stronger, and more vibrant communities. To learn how Tyler's civic services software solutions enable communities to streamline, connect, and automate government processes, visit www.tylertech.com/energov. That's www.tylertech.com/energov.